This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. Sound the gifting panic alarm. We've all been there. You need to find the perfect gift. You have absolutely zero ideas, and you don't know where to start. Relax. Now you can use Gift Mode on Etsy. Gift Mode takes the stress out of gifting, so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. Just answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like, and Gift Mode gives you curated gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. Imagine pages of artisan espresso mugs for the coffee connoisseur in your life. Or for the pickleballer, customized paddle covers in every shade imaginable. Etsy's got you covered. Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
...298 men, women, and children were murdered while traveling from Amsterdam to Malaysia after an anti-aircraft missile shredded their airliner over Ukraine. No one has ever taken responsibility. But tonight, you will hear the evidence and the testimony of those who lost family in such an unimaginable way.
I want to know who killed my children.
For 133 years, a colossal statue of General Robert E. Lee towered over a traffic circle near downtown New Orleans. Until, when to the cheers and jeers of onlookers, the Confederacy's most celebrated military hero was hoisted off its pedestal.
Really, what these monuments were a lie.
A lie in what sense?
Well, in the sense that Robert E. Lee was used as an example to send a message to the rest of the country and to all the people that lived here that the Confederacy was a noble cause. And that's just not true.
This is incredible.
Mayor Landrieu agreed to show us what's become of Generals Lee and Beauregard. They've been gathering dust for more than a year.
Wow.
No snapping fingers, no fire escape balcony. Nope, this is not your parents' West Side Story.
Everything scares me about this. It's a huge challenge.
And ladies.
And of course, everybody has an expectation.
60 Minutes spent 4 months behind the scenes as this epic American production gets set to open on Broadway.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Bill Whitaker.
I'm Anderson Cooper.
I'm Nora O'Donnell.
I'm Scott Pelley. Those stories tonight on 60 Minutes.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
With a single shot, 298 men, women, and children were massacred in Ukraine. The dead were traveling from Amsterdam to Malaysia when an anti-aircraft missile shredded their wide-body airliner. That was 6 years ago, and no one has been held accountable. The downing of Malaysia Flight 17 was a shock to the world. How could innocent civilians leaving the Netherlands on vacation to Asia lose their lives in a war Russia started with Ukraine? As we first reported in February, after a years-long investigation, Dutch prosecutors say they know who is responsible. This is the story of the hunt for the suspects charged with 298 counts of murder. In a Dutch hangar, heavy with the smell of fuel and fire, Malaysia Flight 17 has been resurrected from 8,000 fragments. The Boeing 777, 20 feet wide and 200 feet long, was torn by an estimated 800 pieces of shrapnel, each the size of a bullet. A warhead detonated 10 feet to the left of Captain Eugene Chu's windscreen. The Dutch safety board says the greatest density of holes, 102, is through his window. Shrapnel tore through the cockpit and out the other side. The cockpit sheared away, and the rest of the plane flew another minute and a half. Passengers were thrashed by explosive decompression and a 500-mile-an-hour wind at 40 degrees below zero. One passenger was found wearing his oxygen mask.
I want to know who killed my children.
It was July 17, 2014, that Samira Kaler walked her boys, 19-year-old Shaka and 11-year-old Miguel, as far as Amsterdam airport security would let her. The youngest boy was worried.
He hugged me really tight, and he told me, like, "Mom, I'm so afraid to take this plane. You know, I'm so afraid. What happened when the airplane will crash?" I told him, "Miguel, come on. You've been on flights many times. You are with Shaka. Everything is going just to be fine." He said, "You promise me?" I said, "I promise everything will be okay."
The brothers were going to see their grandmother in Bali. Samira planned to come back to the airport the very next day because her middle son, Mika, couldn't get a seat on Flight 17.
So I never got a proper goodbye, said a proper goodbye, and that really is something that I have to deal with for the rest of my life.
I cannot forgive myself that I promised my baby Miguel that everything will be fine. Who am I to tell him that everything is going to be okay?
That's what a son wants to hear from his mother.
Yeah.
But I feel like I lied to him. Who am I to give him that guarantee? It's been like hell. I feel emptiness. I feel sadness. There is a hole in my heart. It will always hurt, and I miss them every day.
Her boys were among 193 Dutch citizens on board.
It's 9/11 for the Netherlands. The Netherlands, all people in the Netherlands were very, very, very shocked.
Shrines in Dutch homes are common, including the one to Piet Ploeg's brother, sister-in-law, and nephew. His nieces didn't go on their family vacation.
You had to tell your nieces what happened.
I don't want to think too much about that moment. It's too emotional for me. I saw my nieces falling in each other's arms when they realized their parents and their brother were dead. And it was a terrible, terrible moment. Yeah.
No one had any understanding that they were going to be flying over a war zone.
Or you didn't think about it. And after MH17, we always think about it.
Flight 17 was 3 hours into a 12-hour route when it came within range of a war. In 2014, Russia dismembered its neighbor to the west. It annexed part of Ukraine. And today, pro-Russian militias supplied and manned by Moscow are fighting to control eastern Ukraine. In the days before the Flight 17 murders, two Ukrainian military planes were shot down. But despite that, the day Flight 17 entered the airspace, 160 airliners crossed over Ukraine. It was cloudy. Flight 17 at 33,000 feet appeared only on radar until it fell through the clouds across 20 square miles.
We consider it a national crisis because if you think, it was not only that we were doing a criminal investigation, but the most important thing in the beginning was the recovery mission.
Andy Kroc is lead investigator for the Netherlands.
First, we needed to recover all the casualties to get them back home so that the next of kin could mourn. Actually, we were in national mourning.
In a nation so small, it seemed everyone knew someone touched by the murders. For days, convoys of hearses stretching beyond sight were met by gauntlets of grief. Fred Vesterbecke is the chief prosecutor who's been on the case from the start.
Have all of the remains been identified?
We were able to identify from the 298 casualties, 296. So for two people, we didn't find any remains.
With no admission of guilt, 350 investigators from five countries began almost 6 years of work.
We started with multiple scenarios in the beginning. One was it an accident that could be discarded quite quickly? The other one, was it an explosion from inside? And the last two, most importantly, was it air-to-air? Like, was it shot by a plane or was it surface-to-air?
Those scenarios narrowed quickly because of a technique new to the police, civilian internet investigators. Just days before the murders, Elliot Higgins started a UK-based group of online detectives that he calls Bellingcat, named for a fable of mice tying a bell to a cat to warn of danger. Higgins found images crowdsourced online.
So this is one of the first videos that was shared online after MH17 was shot down, and it was shared claiming that this was a Buk missile launcher.
And how do you know across all these images that you're looking at the same convoy?
So there's certain details that kind of leap out at us. There's the white truck, but you can see there's a black exhaust pipe on the side of that truck. It's a very small detail, but it does help us show that it's very similar to the truck that's in other photographs and videos.
Matching randomly sourced pictures with geolocation techniques, Higgins and his colleagues spotted an anti-aircraft system in the right place on the right day. Images that had been shot earlier led him to the convoy's starting point.
And that took us back to a town called Kursk. And in Kursk, there's a missile brigade called the 53rd Air Defense Brigade. And we were able to establish for certain the missile launcher came from that particular brigade.
And Kursk is in Russia. And the 53rd Brigade is a Russian military unit.
Yes, and it was probably very likely crewed by Russian crew.
Higgins also discovered the missile system retreating after the shootdown with one incriminating difference.
You're saying that there's a missile missing from this picture.
That's right. So there's one there, and there's one just out the back of there as well. But there should be a missile between these two missiles.
It wasn't long before Elliot Higgins got a call from Dutch investigators.
How important was the information that came from Bellingcat?
That was pretty groundbreaking at that time. So we've learned a lot from them as well. But that's just one layer of the evidence, because we have to build up evidence that can stand in court. We also have the witnesses, forensic evidence, etc.
The investigators told us layers of evidence came from the weapon itself. Its missile warhead is packed with a unique bowtie-shaped shrapnel. This signature shrapnel was found in the bodies of the flight crew. Another layer of evidence came in thousands of phone calls intercepted among Russians and their allies. We have just shot down a plane, a rebel commander said, before realizing the catastrophic mistake. Yet another layer of evidence was supplied by Ukrainian villagers.
You have eyewitnesses to the missile launch, is that correct? More than one?
I'd say I have an eyewitness, and how many? I didn't say how many.
What military unit did the missile system come from?
From the 53rd Brigade of the armed forces of the Russian Federation.
Is there any room for doubt in that?
No, there's no doubt at all.
They don't know who pushed the button, but this past summer, Dutch prosecutors charged three Russians and a Ukrainian with 298 counts of murder. Sergei Dubinsky was head of intelligence for the pro-Russia rebels in Ukraine. Prosecutors say Oleg Pulatov and Leonid Karchenko were involved in delivering the missile system. The highest-ranking Russian accused is Igor Gherkin, a retired colonel in Russian intelligence. He was in charge of the pro-Russia militia in Ukraine. We found him in Moscow, living under the protection of the Russian government. He told us, someone has to be the scapegoat, so they picked me and others who couldn't even theoretically shoot down this plane. The militia did not bring down the Boeing plane. I have no other comment.
How helpful have the Russians been in this investigation over the last 5 years?
Well, I'd say they haven't been helpful at all, because what they should have done is give us all the information and all the proof we needed in this difficult investigation. They should have told us that at the second day after it happened. They should have told us we made a mistake or we did something which shouldn't have happened, and they should have come forward. That is what they should have done, and they never did.
Still unhelpful, the Russians will not extradite the defendants.
If they're convicted, even though they're not in the courtroom, is that enough for you?
No.
Everybody will be haunted by the fact that they're still out there and not in custody.
The trial is scheduled to begin March 9th and will be heard by a panel of three Dutch judges. Samira Kaler told us she will not attend. Pete Ploeg will not miss it.
The families have the right to speak in court, and I wonder what you intend to say.
I want them to know what they have done, and what they have done to the not only to the victims, but also the next of kin. They have to feel it.
Prosecutors told us their investigation is continuing beyond the trial. They hope to charge additional suspects. For its part, Russia has spun any number of stories about what might have killed 298 innocent victims. Stories that so far have not withstood the evidence presented by the silent witness of Malaysia Flight 17. The trial began as planned in March and will likely run through the end of the year. Samira Kaler still has not attended.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
60 Minutes has been reporting on the debate over Confederate monuments for nearly 3 years. Today, that debate is as charged as arguments to defund American police departments. When we began our research in 2017, we were surprised to learn why and when many of the monuments were built. We decided to go to New Orleans to talk with the mayor at the time, Mitch Landrieu, about his then controversial decision to remove four Confederate monuments. What we saw looked like a military operation.
When the city of New Orleans removed a giant statue of P.G.T. Beauregard, a Confederate general who ordered the first shots fired in the Civil War, they did it in the dead of night. Construction crews wore bulletproof helmets and vests, and police snipers were stationed on rooftops nearby. Mitch Landrieu says it was impossible to find a local company that would take the job.
When we put the thing out to bid, the one contractor that got showed up had his life threatened. He had his car bombed.
His car was actually
firebombed. Death threats would come in, and so I couldn't find a crane. I could not find a damn crane.
In New Orleans?
In New Orleans. I couldn't find a crane in Louisiana.
Mayor Landrieu eventually found a contractor from out of state, and finally, after years of legal wrangling, took down four Confederate monuments. The last one removed was a 16-and-a-half-foot bronze statue of General Robert E. Lee. It had stood for 133 years. Until May 19, 2017, when, to the cheers and jeers of onlookers, the Confederacy's most celebrated military hero was hoisted off its 68-foot pedestal.
In a city that I represent, that's 67% African-American, to have a young African-American girl pass by that statue and look at it every day, I ask myself, am I really preparing for her a really good future? Is she feeling like she's getting lifted up by the government, or is she being put down? I mean, I think the answer's pretty clear. Really, what these monuments were a lie.
A lie in what sense?
Well, in the sense that Robert E. Lee was used as an example to send a message to the rest of the country and to all the people that lived here that the Confederacy was a noble cause. And that's just not true.
This is incredible.
Mayor Landrieu agreed to show us what's become of Generals Lee and Beauregard. They've been gathering dust for more than a year.
Pretty big. That's the first time I've seen them there.
Is that right?
Uh-huh. They're pretty daunting.
Hidden away in this hastily built plywood shed in a location we were asked not to reveal.
And you can see they're in their Civil War gear, their military monuments. You know, they're there to revere them for their military service in propagation of the Civil War.
You look at these monuments, you would never know the Confederacy lost.
Well, that was the whole point. The whole point was to convince people that actually they won, and even in their defeat, it was a noble cause. And of course, the whole point of this is to confront history. I mean, this wasn't an LSU-Alabama football game where it didn't matter who won or lost and you just got bragging rights. I mean, we were talking about millions of people enslaved, 600,000 American citizens were killed, and they were trying to destroy the country.
The statue's final fate is unclear, but they're unlikely to ever be displayed again on public property in the city of New Orleans.
I really did want to make a definitive statement as a white man from the South, as the mayor of a major American city at the dawning of the 21st century, that it's not unclear anymore about what the Civil War was about and who won and what the values are that we should really revere.
After the removal of the statues in New Orleans and the violence in Charlottesville, cities, universities, and activists across the country began rethinking what Confederate monuments said about their values. Several were removed in Baltimore and also in Austin, Texas. In Durham, North Carolina, protesters tore down a statue of a Confederate soldier outside an old courthouse. No state has more Confederate monuments to revere or revile than the Commonwealth of Virginia. In Richmond, the capital, there's a contentious debate about what to do about five prominent Confederate statues on Monument Avenue.
All these years later, the Civil War, in many ways, is still contested ground. This is contested ground.
This is ground zero of this debate.
Absolutely, in large part because it was the capital of Confederacy.
Julian Hayter is a historian at the University of Richmond.
Monument Avenue is not just a national tourist attraction, but an international tourist attraction.
Monument Avenue is like a Confederate walk of fame. There are the generals, Robert E. Lee and his horse, Traveler, Stonewall Jackson and Jeb Stuart, the president of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, and finally, Matthew Fontaine Maury, a somewhat more obscure figure who tried and failed to start a Confederate colony in Mexico.
Those monuments, in many ways, are part and parcel of what we call the lost cause.
The lost cause, what does that mean?
The lost cause, quite frankly, is just the Confederate reinterpretation of the Civil War. It's created almost immediately after the war ends by Confederate leadership. It was hard for a lot of people, in my estimation, to believe that their ancestors died and fought for an ignoble cause. 600,000 people died in the Civil War, which is more Americans than died in the Second World War. And people had to make sense of that.
Believers in the lost cause who raised money to build monuments in towns and cities across the country were often veterans or their widows and children. Lost cause ideology portrayed Confederate soldiers as heroes defending states' rights against Northern aggression and downplayed slavery's role in causing the war. The first Confederate statue on Monument Avenue wasn't built until 1890, 25 years after the Civil War ended. The last one went up in 1929.
You've written that these statues serve white supremacy.
Sure. And that, by the way, is a critical component of the Lost Cause. The idea that African Americans were not only happy slaves, but they were unprepared for freedom. The idea that African Americans were helpless after the Civil War. And in that way, it represents a continuation of the ways that whites think about black folks' intellectual abilities, not just during slavery, but shortly thereafter.
In the years after slavery was abolished and the Civil War ended, what became known as Jim Crow laws were passed that made African Americans second-class citizens.
There are laws that disenfranchise African Americans from the 15th Amendment's right to vote. There are laws that restrict their movements. They represent, more broadly, the attempt to reassert control over African Americans after the abolition of slavery.
And these monuments are part of that?
Oh, absolutely. They're just as much a part of Jim Crow as they are of the Civil War and slavery. That's when they were built. They were built in the 20th century. Very few people seem to understand that these monuments were built during segregation.
The monuments are just a symbol of the effort to ensure African Americans stayed, maybe not in physical bondage, but in bondage and political and economically in this country and in this city.
Richmond's Mayor LeVar Stoney created a commission in 2017 on the future of Monument Avenue.
Those who chose to erect those monuments and the figures who are glorified in those monuments, they made some serious attempts to ensure that people who look like me would never hold any political office ever in Virginia.
With Charlottesville, I mean, were you surprised at how many people were willing to come out and show their true colors, show their Nazi flags?
I think it woke a lot of people up, not just here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, but around the country.
There have been protests in Richmond over the future of Monument Avenue. Mayor Stoney says he wants the statues taken down.
It is, for me, the greatest example of nostalgia masquerading as history.
It's not real history.
It's the fake news of their time.
Well, he and I just disagree. They're a part of history.
William J. Cooper says removing Confederate monuments is a mistake. He was a professor of history at Louisiana State University for 46 years and is a past president of the Southern Historical Association.
One of the things that Mitch Landry said that stuck in my mind, he said there's a difference between remembrance of history and reverence for it, and that these statues are revering a false history.
Well, it's not a false history. It's not a false history. A monument was put up there by real people who had real beliefs. Maybe we don't like their beliefs. But one of the things that bothers me most as a historian is what I call presentism, judging the past by the present, figuring that we're the only moral people, that nobody else could be moral if they didn't think like we think.
When you hear people saying that these monuments celebrate white supremacy, because that's sort of the common refrain.
Well, when you say celebrate white supremacy, that's not incorrect. I mean, they do celebrate white supremacy, but they weren't put up to celebrate white supremacy.
Really?
No, they were put up to celebrate the Confederacy.
But if the statues do celebrate white supremacy, should they be up today?
Well, should Mount Vernon be up today? Should we go burn Monticello down tomorrow? Certainly Thomas Jefferson believed in white supremacy.
You're saying this is a slippery slope.
That's a very slippery slope.
I would say the difference, the critical difference between Washington and Jefferson and Lee and men like Lee is that while Washington and Jefferson were complicated individuals and by our standards thought about ideas in an intolerably anachronistic way, they also baked into the Constitution the components that allowed people to dismantle the slave system. They built as much as they destroyed. I cannot say the same thing for the Confederacy.
Professor Hayter was appointed by Richmond's mayor to the commission that's going to make recommendations on what should happen on Monument Avenue.
There are 75 million people in the South who are the descendants of Confederate soldiers. And who am I to tell them that they cannot celebrate their ancestor in a particular way? But I also have ancestors who were the victims of the slave system. And I see no reason why we can't find a usable way to tell two stories or tell multiple stories.
That tell the truth.
Not a romanticized version of the truth, where people are trying to absolve themselves from the deep inhumanities of what the Confederacy stood for. people who are willing to face down history for what it is, in all its ugliness and all its beauty.
Do you believe the statue should be removed?
No. I'm a historian, and I think that the statues should stay with a footnote of epic proportions.
Essentially, you're suggesting...
I'm suggesting we do a little bit of historical jujitsu. Right? I'm suggesting we use the scale and grandeur of those monuments against themselves. I think we lack imagination when we talk about memorials. It's all or nothing. It's leave them this way or tear them down, as if there's nothing in between that we could do to tell a more enriching story about American history.
Historians call it recontextualization, the addition of signs or markers with information about when and why the statues were built to help people see old monuments in a new light.
So you'd like to see signs or placards or historical lessons somewhere around here?
Right. Perhaps even on this sidewalk.
So that as people approach the statue...
They can read the story of...
And they can understand the context in which it was built.
Absolutely.
And the reason it was built.
Yep. You could have a glass placard here, and etched into that glass placard would be a story. And then when you look through it, you can still see the Lee Monument. Mm. But you see it through the lens of a more accurate historical depiction.
Whatever recommendations made by Julian Hayter and the Monument Commission he serves on may have a limited impact. Unlike in New Orleans, the Confederate statues here may be protected by state law, and the Republican-controlled Virginia General Assembly is unlikely to approve major changes anytime soon. One person who that might have disappointed is Robert E. Lee. Before he died in 1870, he was on record opposing the building of Civil War monuments in the North and the South. Wiser, he once wrote, not to keep open the sores of war. Last month, protesters tore down Jefferson Davis's statue on Monument Avenue. President Trump recently signed an executive order designed to prevent protesters from doing just that. However, Mayor Stoney has since removed eight other Confederate monuments in Richmond, and Virginia's governor has ordered General Robert E. Lee's statue, the last one left on Monument Avenue, to be taken down as soon as possible.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Broadway is dark. Curtains won't rise again before the new year. But we have a revival of our look at the new production of West Side Story. As we first reported this February, days before it opened and weeks before COVID-19 temporarily shut it down, a new team of creative artists has staged a radical re-envisioning of the classic musical. When the original West Side Story opened in 1957, it caused a sensation with the innovative fusion of dance, music, and theater, a reimagining of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. Tony and Maria are the star-crossed lovers. Rival street gangs, the Jets and the Sharks, become the Montagues and the Capulets. We were given unprecedented access to the making of the new production. It's stripped down, fast and gritty, a West Side Story for the 21st century. We started rolling our cameras this past October in a Manhattan dance studio. Who knows? The first notes of Leonard Bernstein's music and Stephen Sondheim's lyrics stirred treasured memories. I will know right away, soon as it shows. But Ivo van Hove, a Tony Award-winning director, known for his cutting-edge productions, promises something new, a more raw and raging West Side Story.
When you're a jet, you're the swingin'est thing. Little boy, you're a man. Little man, you're a king.
It's van Hove's first Broadway musical. Updating this American masterpiece was his idea. The Belgian director says the story is universal.
Jumping into this American classic, there must be things about this that just scare you.
Everything scares me about this. It's a huge challenge because everything has to be on the highest level, the singing, the dancing, and the acting. And of course, everybody has an expectation.
And push! Don't forget I'm an American.
The songs and Arthur Lawrence's story are the same, but the dancing, all new.
Okay, one more time.
Van Hove tapped choreographer Anna Teresa de Keersmacher,
1, 2,
his friend and fellow Belgian, to design more contemporary, street-influenced movement.
Why waste my time in America?
You forget I'm in America. Can the ladies, could you think that there is a way that you would be closer to the guys? Let's try once not to have unified steps. On the first curve, you don't gonna come in straight line.
This is your first Broadway production.
Yes, yes. And
this is a different animal.
Would you call it an animal? What kind of animal? A lion? A serpent? A dragon? Maybe a dragon. No?
Is that what it feels like sometimes?
It's huge. It's a lot of people. There's a lot at stake. And it's teamwork. You know, with clear leaders being Ivo and I. Ivo, tell me, what is the situation?
Their young cast reflects America today. In this version, the Jets are not all white, and the Sharks are not just Puerto Ricans. They're recent Latino immigrants. 33 of the 50 cast members are making their Broadway debuts.
Puerto Rico's in America.
It's not easy to sing these songs. You have to dance at the same time most of the time, and you have to be able to act. So that's a very difficult thing when you're very young and when you don't have a lot of experience.
The Sharks will be here.
Van Hove is animated, decisive. De Keersmacher calls herself a patient collaborator.
So I don't need a military line like this. I don't want to organize it like an army. I'm not a general. I'm not like check, 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 check. We start to shape it together with the dancers.
Her style is vastly different from the original balletic dancing of director-choreographer Jerome Robbins, immortalized in the 1961 movie.
So how do you change something like America? The way she throws the dress around.
Those dresses are very beautiful. They really enlarge the movement. But that's not the way young people dance these days.
So that's out.
That's out.
No snapping of the fingers.
No snapping of the fingers.
No, because it's not in the score. It's an invention of Jerome Robbins, and we should respect that, you know? You can be inspired by other people, but not stealing from them, I think.
This was their vision. After 5 weeks in the rehearsal hall, the last run-through before moving to the theater. Two days later, on November 18th, the production went uptown to the Broadway Theater.
We made it. Here we are.
The scenery is an enormous black wall that opens up to reveal two hidden sets. Central to Van Hove's reimagining, cameras everywhere, 25 of them, projecting images onto the wall, designed to intensify the action. It's video on a scale Broadway has never seen.
I would like sort of curve it.
De Keersmacher had to scale up her dancers' movements to fit the bigger space and giant images.
Video-wise, we have now to explore what we do there.
Veteran producer Scott Rudin is the money and power behind this production.
So when the audience walks in, that's what they're going to see?
That's it. That's West Side Story. It's a black box, fully exposed, guts and all. It's not West Side Story of 1957. It's just not that.
It's huge. Are you concerned at all that that video image will overwhelm your actors on stage?
I think we're managing our way into it. There are places where I think it still does slightly overwhelm or kind of dwarf the actors, and some places where it's incredibly exciting that it's there. But it's been a fascinating toolkit to play with.
It is off stage.
Isaac Powell and Shireen Pimentel play the doomed lovers, Tony and Maria. They took us to what they call a secret set, four flights up above the stage, out of sight of the audience.
They have a camera set up right here.
In what was once a dressing room, now is Maria's bedroom.
There's a camera set up in the bedroom.
So in the play, yes, you'll be running up and down the stairs to come to your room.
Yep.
So is this a theater or a movie set?
Why does it have to be either?
Exactly.
It's both.
It's happening in real time.
Seamlessly?
Sometimes. Of course, there are bound to be bumps and kinks that need to be ironed out.
I saw him now into his frame.
We saw some of those kinks the first time in the theater Van Hove rehearsed the bedroom scene when Maria learns Tony has killed her brother. It was like directing a movie. He blocked it with the actors and cameras, then went down to the theater to watch it unfold on the video wall.
I see him again, but this goes wrong, huh? No, oh, no, she should not stand there. It's out of focus. Out of focus, guys. This is so many mistakes. Yeah, I give you a moment, but I was there already explaining five times. You know, it's not that difficult.
We were here one day when you were rehearsing the bedroom scene upstairs. The camera was out of focus. The actors were out of position. You were getting angry. You at one point said, everything is wrong. So much of this is wrong. Did you ever have any questions through that about the use of the video like that?
No.
Never. It never made you have doubt.
The challenges were high. And of course, we know that it will be a journey, you know, and it took us a while to bring all the elements, you know, in a perfect balance. So, no, it's a normal process. In this case, a very intense one. Come on. Bang. Where's the ring?
Something else they had to fix, the rain. A deluge that soaks the actors and sometimes musicians in the orchestra pit.
Let's go on.
The calm in the middle of the storm, Ivo Van Hove.
You take notes on everything. The next day you go up and you have production meetings with the crew and you go work with the actors. I mean, this seems like a grueling process.
I love that. I feel like a fish in the ocean, you know? And the ocean is a dangerous place to be sometimes, you know, but also a great place to be. I love the sometimes violent, but always the high energy of a rehearsal process.
As the show evolved, we saw as much drama offstage as on.
Sharks, here's what we're missing.
Two Latin dance consultants were brought in to add more authenticity and Broadway flair to de Kiersbacher's choreography.
Try that again, please.
I don't like when they start to fuzzle with your material.
Is that what they were doing, fuzzling with your material?
Well, there is a certain codified language in Broadway. You know, how a number has to end, how you have to build tension, you know. And it's true, I don't have so much experience about that. I think finally it turned out well, but I would be lying if I say that it went like smoothly like this, you know.
Somewhere, a place for us. It seemed the show was snake bit. Isaac Powell, Tony, injured his knee and had to take a month off. That delayed opening night by 2 weeks. Veteran actor Ben Cook, who played Riff, the leader of the Jets, dislocated his shoulder and had to leave the show 6 weeks before opening, giving 22-year-old castmate Duran Jones, a newcomer to Broadway, the break of a lifetime. Then protest erupted over Amar Ramasar, a dancer with the New York City Ballet who plays the leader of the Sharks. He's been named in a civil suit alleging he participated in an exchange of explicit pictures of female dancers, which he contests. Ramasar was initially fired by the New York City Ballet.
The arbitrator found that there had been no firing offense. He got reinstated. I don't excuse it. I think what he did was really stupid. I mean, am I supposed to replace him in the show? I'm not going to do that.
After 19 weeks, the performances have been polished, the video fine-tuned, the dancing distinct. They're ready, after all the blood, sweat, and tears.
It's a bit like a battlefield, you know, it's a battlefield and you have to behave like a general.
You told us originally that you are not a general.
Yeah, I know. I'm not a general, but I'm a dancer, so I mean I'm flexible. I have patience. In Italian, they say, l'ho voluto la bicicletta. They say, you wanted the bicycle, so now you have to...
pedal.
You have to pedal, you know. I made the choice of doing this. I knew it was not going to be easy, so l'ho voluto la bicicletta. Yeah, now pedal.
And now they ride into the uncertainty of opening night. The jets are in gear, our cylinders
are clinking. I was at the birth of this thing. I know exactly what I wanted it to be. Here come the jets. The whole vision has been realized, and I'm really happy with that. Am I always successful? No. Will this be successful? We'll see. It's up to you, you know, to judge that. It's not up to me. I did everything possible with my team. Here come the Jets, yeah. We're gonna beat every last bugging gang on the whole bugging street, on the whole ever mother loving.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I'm Scott Pelley. We'll be back next week with another edition of 60 Minutes.
We're in Rome to meet Pope Francis for a rare, wide-ranging interview.
Do you like when you are called the people's pope?
El Papa de la gente.
It is very important to talk about the future. You have called for a ceasefire. Can you help negotiate peace?
Join us for our special hour with His Holiness on CBS.
Pope Francis the First, a CBS News primetime special, tomorrow on CBS and streaming on Paramount Plus.
I'm CBS News correspondent Major Garrett, host of the podcast Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen. During the Cold War, FBI agent Robert Hansen traded classified secrets to the Kremlin in exchange for cash and jewels. In the podcast, you'll hear from Hansen's closest friends, family members, victims, and colleagues for the most comprehensive telling of who Robert Hansen really was. Binge the entire series now. Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen is available on the Wondery app, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It was the biggest scandal in pop music. The stars of Milli Vanilli, the Grammy-winning multi-platinum R&B phenomenon, were exposed as frauds. But none of this was their idea. So whose idea was it? Enter German music producer Frank Farian. He saw the success of acts like Michael Jackson and Prince, and he wanted in, no matter the cost. So he devised the perfect pop heist. Two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? They couldn't sing. But Frank knew just how to fix that. Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's greatest controversies and takes a never-before-heard look at the exploitation of two young Black artists. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when the truth came out, Rob and Fab were the only ones who got burned. Looking back now, it's hard not to wonder, why did everyone blame them and not the man pulling the strings? Follow Blame It on the Fame, Milli Vanilli, on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.